Welcome to Abide in Liberty, a podcast empowering patriots everywhere to re-enthrone faith, family, and freedom as the bedrock pillars of liberty in education, our communities, and our nation.
Welcome, everybody. Thank you for joining me again. My name is Braden Hayes, and I am your host. Since recording that introduction episode, I have not been able to wait to get started into the meat of what I've been wanting to talk about. Today, I plan to debunk the myth of spiritual neutrality. This is foundational to the next several weeks and months of topics that I have planned. So we're going to jump right in. But before I do that, I want to engage through this podcast in a conversation with you. I'd like for you to tell me if you think of counterarguments or points that I don't address clearly enough. Let me know if you see any weaknesses in my logic or maybe just weaknesses in areas that I didn't touch on. And the way you can do that is through my YouTube channel for this podcast. If you go to YouTube and search for Abide in Liberty and find this podcast episode, and in those comments, put your comments or your concerns or your challenges to what I'm talking about, I will read those and I will address them in the next episode. So without further ado, let's jump right in. Back in the 1960s, our country gave God the boot. In one particular school, teachers were leading students in prayer every morning, and participation in this was optional, but there were some parents who complained, filed a lawsuit, and the Supreme Court ruled that doing this was unconstitutional, and we'll get into more on that later. Now, why were parents complaining? Well, parents of differing beliefs were understandably concerned about their children being pushed or influenced into things that were contrary to what they believed and what they taught in their home. So the idea here was to remove God from the equation and create a spiritually neutral education that would work for everyone, for students of all faiths. Now, that may sound great. That sounds like a nice idea, a place where everyone can feel comfortable and can learn and not feel that their beliefs are challenged. What actually ended up happening, though, was this kicked off a flurry of anti-Christian and anti-God court rulings in the subsequent decades. I want to read a couple summaries of some of these court cases. I'm just going to give you a small sampling, and I'm pulling this from a book that I recommended in my last episode to all of you called Original Intent by David Barton. And I'm just picking out some of my favorites. Well, not my favorites, but some of the more shocking ones, at least. But there are many, many others that I did not choose. It was determined that it was unconstitutional for a courtroom to display the Ten Commandments alongside other founding documents like the Magna Carta, the Declaration of Independence, and the Mayflower Compact. It was unconstitutional for a nativity scene to be displayed on public property unless it's surrounded by sufficient secular displays in order to prevent it from appearing religious. It was unconstitutional for Christians to pray public prayers that reflect their own personal faith and beliefs. In Dufuniac Springs, Florida, a judge ordered that a copy of the Ten Commandments in the courthouse be covered up during a murder trial, fearing that the jurors might see the commandment, "Thou shalt not kill," and would be prejudiced against the defendant. We wouldn't want people to think that killing is wrong. In Russellville, Kentucky, a library employee was barred from wearing her necklace because it had a small cross on it. And in Clymer, Pennsylvania, a school employee was suspended for wearing a necklace with a cross. In Memphis, Tennessee, a library that offered shelves, and this one's hilarious. This is probably one of my favorites. The library had a shelf where they could display, the community could display advertisements and announcements. But when a local church put a notification in there of its upcoming Christmas pageant that included a small nativity scene on the shelf, the library required that they remove Joseph, Mary, Jesus, and the wise men from the scene, leaving only the farm animals. If students are given the ability to create artwork of their own choosing, it's unconstitutional for them to include a religious image in their artwork. Student artwork containing religious symbols like a Bible or a cross can be treated as gang symbols, profanity, and satanic signs. In 9 of the Western states, it was ruled constitutional for a public school to require a 3-week course to the Islamic faith in which all junior high students must pretend that they are Muslims and offer prayers to Allah. They were also encouraged to take Islamic names, call each other by those names, and wear Islamic garb, participate in jihad games, and read the Quran during those 3 weeks. But that same court ruled it unconstitutional for those students to voluntarily mention "under God" in the Pledge of Allegiance. It was determined that it was unconstitutional to even see 10 Commandments at school, since students might voluntarily read, meditate upon, respect, and obey them. Oh no. If there's one thing we don't want, it's people obeying the Ten Commandments. A classroom library can't contain books that deal with Christianity or for a teacher to even be seen with his copy of the Bible at school. A speaker is not allowed to deliver a secular message to public schools if that expert is also publicly known to be a Christian. It's unconstitutional for a kindergarten class to ask whose birthday is celebrated by Christmas. In St. Louis, Missouri, a school official caught an elementary student praying over his lunch, and he was taken to the principal and ordered to not pray anymore. Personal Bibles of 2 students in one school were taken away from them, and they were threatened that Child Protective Services would be called on them if they continued to bring in that Bible. When in Dixon, Tennessee, high school students were required to write a paper on any topic of their choosing and to use at least 4 research sources. Some students wrote about things like reincarnation, witchcraft, and the occult, but the student who chose to write about the life of Christ was the one given a 0 by her teacher for choosing that topic. Does any of this sound neutral to you? Regardless of the good intentions of those who supported this law in the 1960s, what we got was a public square and a public school system that was hostile to faith and Christianity. We way missed the mark, but the question I want to answer in this episode is spiritual neutrality even possible? Now, when I was preparing for this, one of the first thoughts I had came from Star Wars. I'm a huge Star Wars fan. I love the movies. And the scene that came to mind was from the end of Revenge of the Sith. And this is kind of the final showdown between Obi-Wan Kenobi and Anakin Skywalker. And this is after Anakin has killed all the young Jedis in training. He's officially joined the evil Emperor Palpatine. He's just finished murdering his former allies in cold blood. And when Obi-Wan Kenobi shows up and confronts him with all of this, he's still got this glimmer of hope that maybe there's something I can do to help bring Anakin back, right? He's trying, he's nervous and he's scared, but he's not giving up hope. But then Anakin says something, and this is the straw that breaks the camel's back. All these other terrible things have happened, but this one statement is what convinces Obi-Wan Kenobi that his former student is beyond hope. He's beyond redemption. There's nothing that he can do to salvage Anakin's soul at this point. And here's what Anakin said: "If you're not with me, you're against me." And at this point, oh man, Obi-Wan just, he deflates, his head, his, you know, his shoulders slump. And he says, "Only a Sith deals in absolutes. I will do what I must." At which point he reaches for his lightsaber and he commences trying to take out Anakin Skywalker. Now, is Obi-Wan right here? Is such black and white thinking just plain evil, like Obi-Wan Kenobi makes it sound like it is? There's someone else who said something similar that I think answers this question pretty soundly. He said something like this: "He that is not with me is against me, and he that gathereth not with me scattereth abroad." Matthew chapter 12, verse 30. "For he that is not against us is on our part." Mark chapter 9, verse 40. "And Jesus said unto him, Forbid him not, for he that is not against us is for us." Luke chapter 9, verse 50. Yes, this was Christ making these same absolute statements of right and wrong, that if you're not with Christ, you're against him. So either Christ is a Sith Lord, or George Lucas and his writers got this a little bit wrong. Now, fortunately, I'm happy to report that God and Christ believe in absolutes, and at the same time, they are not Sith Lords after all. Turns out there is such a thing as truth and error. There is good and evil, and there is no middle ground. You're either working towards God or you're moving the other direction. You cannot serve two masters, for either you will love the one and despise the other, or you will hate the one and cling to the other. You cannot serve God and mammon. Again, there's only two options here. Turns out George Lucas just got it wrong. He's a great visionary filmmaker, and I love the movies, but turns out he's not doctrinally perfect. Now, the counter argument that I've heard before is that science is actually neutral because it just takes faith out of the equation altogether by operating from an assumption that God doesn't exist because you can't prove his existence. And we've adopted this scientific framework for schools, the workplace, and the public square at large. So, you know, you might say maybe we've not been great at being neutral and living up to that ideal, but we can work on it. We can figure out how to just not talk about God, but still keep it neutral. And you just have to teach in schools without the faith stuff. You just kind of have to with the mix and the variety of people and backgrounds that we have. We don't really have much of a choice if we're going to be fair. First of all, if you believe that God is real and is the source of all truth, then thinking that kicking the source of that truth out of places that are supposedly teaching truth is just a bona fide contradiction. It's kind of like a power company who thinks it can still deliver power and electricity to your home by shutting off the source of that power, the power plants. The power company might be selling you something, but it ain't electricity. Schools that turn off the source of truth might be teaching something, but it's not truth that is pure and undefiled. And it turns out that teaching without God is actually not neutral after all. It's just a different kind of faith system. What we've replaced theism with, and theism is a faith in God, what we've replaced that with in school in the public square, something called secular humanism. And secular humanism, from their own sources, is inherently atheistic. And one of its major criticisms of theism, which is a belief in God, is that the fundamental premise of theism is unprovable scientifically. So theism can't work because you can't prove that God exists scientifically. In a movie that I watched a couple years ago called The Case for Christ, and I highly recommend it to you, a journalist sets out on kind of a self-proclaimed mission to prove that God does not exist. He's an atheist, and his wife converts to Christianity, so he just has to prove to her why the decision that she made to become a Christian is a bad one. So he looks at biblical evidence, he looks at all the miracles that the Bible claims happen, and tries to find scientific proof that says you can't, that these miracles couldn't happen. And what he finds is kind of a mixed bag. So for example, the bleeding from every pore, he finds some documented scientific examples of when people who are undergoing intense emotional pressure and stress actually bled from their pores. Their capillaries are just overwhelmed and the blood kind of squeezes out and it looks like small amounts of sweating blood, which is exactly what is talked about in the Bible when Christ is suffering in the Garden of Gethsemane. But then there are other examples of, for example, raising people from the dead that is a little bit problematic scientifically. So he comes to the point where he's just confused. And so he goes to one of his atheistic mentors who basically points out that either position, believing that God is real or believing that he doesn't exist, requires an act of faith. But why is that? Why does atheism require an act of faith? What's interesting is that the fundamental underlying assumption of secular humanism is just as unprovable as proving that God exists. So let's consider for a minute why that is. To prove that something doesn't exist is not as simple as it might appear. Let's say, for example, that I want to prove that there is no 75-inch TV in my house. I could do that by searching every room and photographing every square inch of my home from top to bottom. And armed with that proof, with that photographic proof, I would feel quite comfortable stating with absolute certainty that there is, much to my dismay, no 75-inch TV in my house. Now, to set about proving that God doesn't exist, you kind of have to widen your search parameters a little bit. You can't just stop at your house. You kind of have to explore every corner of the known and unknown universe. You've got to look for him and come back empty-handed, but not even that's enough. What if, as you are conducting this search of the universe, and you finish your search of the Milky Way galaxy, and you're on your way to the Andromeda galaxy, and God moves from Bode's galaxy to the Milky Way galaxy. Kind of like, you know, trying to find a lost child in a grocery store. That child's moving around and you just keep missing each other. So in order to be able to prove that he doesn't exist, you've got to be able to explore every corner of the known and unknown universe all at the same time. Now, we have a word for that. That's called being omnipresent. You've got to be everywhere all at once. Now, let's just assume for argument's sake that you could pull that off. That's still not enough. Human senses are limited, and there's much that our senses and our even most sensitive instruments can't see and understand. Dark matter, for example. So not only do you have to be everywhere all at once, you've got to be able to see the fabric of the universe in all of its infinite complexity. Otherwise, you run the risk of, you know, like an ant climbing your toe, missing completely the fact that the thing that you're climbing and exploring belongs to a being many times more large and complex than itself. We have a word for that too, and it's called being omniscient. You'd have to know everything and be able to perceive and comprehend everything. Now imagine the power that such a person would have, somebody who is all-knowing and present everywhere all at once. The power of such a being would be incredible. It would surpass anything else in the universe. You would truly be all-powerful. And we have a word for that too. It's called omnipotent. And these three words, omnipresent, omniscient, and omnipotent, are words that we use to describe God himself. So it turns out that the only person who could prove scientifically secular humanism's premise that God doesn't exist is God himself. Though why he would want to undertake such a silly project is beyond me. So what it comes down to is that when our country was faced with the decision between Christianity and neutrality in our schools and in our public places, it was given a false decision. It was given a false choice. The choice was actually Christian belief system or an anti-God belief system. And somehow in the 1960s, when over 90% of Americans were Christian, our country bought this lie of neutrality. When less than 10% of the population felt marginalized, we decided to trade that for a secular humanist perspective that less than 10% of the population felt comfortable with, but where 90% of the population was now under attack and marginalized. How does that make sense, and how in the world is that neutral? I hate to break it to you, but God was not fist pumping in heaven or over being kicked out because it was somehow more fair to his children. This was not a step in the right direction and not one that he was happy with. Now, how can I say that? It's pretty simple. His prophet Moroni makes pretty clear how you can tell the types of things that God is happy with and the types of things that he isn't. He said, "The way to judge is plain as the daylight is from the dark night." Again, we've got this dichotomy, daylight and darkness. It's simple. "Everything which inviteth to do good and to persuade to believe in Christ is sent forth by the power and gift of Christ. But whatsoever thing persuadeth men to do evil and believe not in Christ and deny him and serve not God, then you may know with a perfect knowledge it is of the devil." Unless you can somehow make a case that someone kicking God out was a clever way to persuade more people to believe in him and follow Christ, then kicking God out of our schools and out of the public square was of the devil, period. I want to end where I began in the 1960s. Let's go back to that question. Is it right to force someone to have their kids educated in an environment that undermines what they're teaching their kids at home and what they believe in? We decided in the 60s that the answer to that question was no. And in a land that was built with freedom of conscience as the first freedom protected by the Bill of Rights, I believe that to be the right answer. That's my personal belief. But just like the atheists have a right to not have Christianity peddled to their kids in schools, Christians, Muslims, Jews, and others have a right to not be forced into educating their children in an environment that is devoid of God in the best case and blatantly anti-God in the worst case. Nothing really changed in the 1960s. We just substituted one religion for another. And what's been the result? By their fruits, ye shall know them. Since that time, has faith in God been flat, which is what you would expect if this godless, neutral worldview truly were neutral? Charles F. Potter was a popular proponent of secular humanism, and he said, "Education is thus a most powerful ally of humanism, and every American public school is a school of humanism. What can the theistic Sunday schools, meeting for an hour once a week and teaching only a fraction of the children, do to stem the tide of a five-day program of humanist teaching?" Now, I know you might be saying, "No, but I do scripture study with my kids before I go to school, and we have conversations, but does it measure up to the amount of time that they're spending in a secular humanist environment? Ratios are important." Does that quote to you sound neutral? Of course not, because neutrality is not a thing in this battle for human souls, and the other side does not see neutrality here. And it's high time that we Christians wake up to that fact and do something about it. Now, you might be wondering, what do we do about it? And this is why I personally love school choice. Let parents take their kids to whichever school best supports their values without financial hardship. Now, in the media and elsewhere, this raises questions of separation of church and state. And that topic deserves its own podcast, which incidentally is what I'm going to talk about next week. We'll talk about what separation of church and state actually means. Where did it come from? And how did we go from reading the Bible in schools for the first 150 years of our country's history? And now in many schools, you can't even wish your friends Merry Christmas without fear of detention. We'll answer all that and more in next week's podcast.
Thank you for listening to Abide in Liberty. Make sure you subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes and share this with friends and family. In the meantime, keep up with the show online at abideinliberty.com. Also, if you'd like to help our K-12 bless and educate more families, contact us by visiting libertyyouthacademy.org. Until next time, be on the alert, stand firm in the faith, and be strong.